This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. Well, the stock market may be pretty tough to predict, but here's what's not that tough to predict. Humans trading stocks and making investment decisions will inevitably make mistakes, sometimes with tragic consequences. MIT's Andrew Ngo argues that evolutionary biology may be the key to a new way of understanding how humans react to financial choices and how they'll tend to behave in the future. Andrew Ngo, professor of finance and director of the Laboratory for Financial Engineering at MIT Sloan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So my first question is, why use evolutionary biology at all to explain how people make financial decisions?
Well, you know, this is not something that I came to when I first started out as a finance professor. Most finance professors actually like to use a lot of mathematics, and we actually suffer from a disease that I call physics envy. You know, we'd love to have three laws that explain 99% of all behavior the way physicists have. The problem is that those three laws don't really exist. In fact, we have maybe 99 laws that explain 3% of human behavior. And so eventually, just from knocking my head against these walls, I came to the realization that evolutionary biology has more to say about how economics evolves than physics or mathematics.
Okay, so then how do you fit in things like natural selection, which you think of as, okay, well, this plays a role in the African savanna. How do you fit that kind of thing in with the stock trading that people do every day?
Well, you know, here's a good example. One of the things that you'll notice if you go to visit one of these high-powered trading firms on Wall Street, when you look across the trading floor, you notice that there are very few old traders. Most of the traders are pretty young, 20s and 30s. And it's pretty clear that the process of trading is an emotionally and physically taxing kind of a profession. And so right there, you see a little bit of evolution before your very eyes. The fact is that you don't have very old individuals involved in trading because it's just not the kind of thing that, allows one to be able to do that over years and years.
So then you're missing out, it sounds like, on the wisdom component. If you've got a lot of sort of very strong young people in their 20s and 30s, you might have strength and risk-taking on your side. But I wonder if you have the, wait a minute, let's sit back for a second and think about what's going on here.
Well, certainly, I think that's a factor. Now, it's true that as traders get older, very often they go into senior management positions. And in that case, I think you have a very positive kind of a dynamic. But there's no doubt that when you have a very fast-growing economy, you can have a number of younger traders who don't have the experience and the life lessons that you need in order to manage those kinds of risks. So that's an example where evolution and natural selection ultimately end up working against you in terms of creating opportunities.
So then you're selecting for the people who seem strong, but in some ways those are not the best decision make. So evolution and financial markets are like at cross purposes there.
Well, it can be. I mean, evolution, both in biology as well as in financial markets, is not necessarily a very active, directed process. And in fact, I think it was Ernst Mayr who once said that evolution is really just a matter of the process of elimination. And so in many cases, evolution doesn't necessarily select for, you know, the very best long-term consequences. Ultimately, it just selects for whatever's going to be fittest for the current environment.
So it works in much the same way that if you were trying to avoid a snake on the African savanna, that those are the split-second decisions. So does it reward people who make faster decisions better?
Exactly. In fact, I've argued that what works well on the African savanna does not necessarily work well on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. And so, you know, we have many, many hundreds of thousands of years of evolution that produce certain kinds of reactions, instincts, if you will. Those instincts protect us from physical threats, but they don't necessarily protect us from financial threats.
You know, I talked to Frank Partnoy not that long ago, who teaches about finance also, and he wrote this book called Wait. And I'm going to play you a little clip of him talking about how Lehman Brothers ended up making such bad decisions during the financial crisis. Let's listen to it.
Lehman had tried to design a decision-making course that they had brought four dozen of their top executives to the Palace Hotel on Madison Avenue in New York. They had holed them up there with some famous psychologists and decision-making researchers. This was back in 2005. They'd actually brought in Malcolm Gladwell, who had just published Blink. And Joe Gregory, the president of Lehman Brothers, was very much a go-with-your-gut guy, and he was passing out copies of Blink on the trading floor at Lehman. And the thing that I found was that they apparently didn't learn this lesson about the virtues of delay and decision-making because they very quickly marched back to their headquarters in Times Square and made the worst snap decisions in the history of financial markets, which blew up their firm.
Andrew Lowe from MIT, what happened there at the sort of trough of the financial markets when things were going really bad and people were saying, go with your gut? What happened?
Well, you know, it's a complicated set of issues, and no doubt split-second decision-making is appropriate for certain contexts but not for others. But with Lehman Brothers, we have to remember that that was a situation that was developing over many, many years. And Lehman, until it blew up, was one of the most successful firms on Wall Street. I mean, over the course of the 12-year period when Lehman went public, remember that the compound rate of return for its shareholders was something like 22% a year for a 12-year period. That's an incredible rate of return. So Lehman was very successful, and its success ultimately allowed it to engage in businesses that many other firms might not have been able to get off the ground. It grew, and it kept on growing to the point where it got involved in some very risky and very illiquid kinds of investments. And so, of course, in 2007 and 2008, when all of these issues came to a head, by that time, Lehman was too big to be able to easily get itself out of these kind of positions.
In an evolutionary sense, what prompts people to take those kinds of risks, knowing, hey, there's a lot of downside here if we trade these certain kinds of derivatives and that kind of thing?
Well, part of the problem is that success breeds additional growth, as all evolutionary processes will do. And so over the years, as Lehman became more successful, they ended up engaging in larger and broader businesses. And ultimately, it got to the point where the businesses that it found itself in could not easily have been unwound over a short period of time. But remember that as a business, your objective is to grow and generate profits for your shareholders. I think Chuck Prince, the CEO of Citigroup at the time, said that when the music is playing, you got to dance. And part of the evolutionary process is growing and then ultimately failing if you can't support that growth.
Okay, so then what do you do at that inflection moment when you realize how important the decisions are in the way that Frank Partnoy talks about, when you realize then how crucial your decisions are?
Well, so humans have a very different capacity than most other animals. We are able to hold abstract ideas in our heads and do what-if analysis. In other words, we can actually allow evolution to occur at the speed of thought. We can come up with various different scenarios and select the one that we think is going to be the most appropriate. We're not always right, but we actually can engage in evolution from a purely metaphysical, theoretical perspective as opposed to a biological one. And so I think the first step is to understand what the dynamics are of financial markets, to understand that natural selection is operating at all times for the various different financial institutions that we're engaged in. Once we understand that kind of dynamic, we can then start to make decisions about how best to deal with those kinds of dynamics when markets turn against us or when the environment is not conducive to the current configuration that we find ourselves in.
So how do you deal with regulating financial markets if you realize that people are going to make decisions that maybe for evolutionary purposes make sense, but for their stock portfolios may make no sense at all?
Well, again, the first step is to understand that this is a possibility and to start thinking about ways of dealing with it ahead of time, in advance of these kind of crises. You know, very often people look at their portfolios only when it's necessary, only when there's a big market movement up or down. The fact is that you need to think about your portfolio on a much more frequent and a much more systematic basis and plan for these kind of events. We know that there are going to be market crashes. We know that there are going to be market booms. So if we can understand exactly what our financial objectives are, if we can plan for those kind of events and at least go through a kind of a fire drill in our own minds as to how we're going to behave during their circumstances, we might actually be able to make better decisions as opposed to deciding at the spur of the moment.
And I know you said actually regulations in terms of the fire code is another example of a system where we know that people make irrational decisions. So we try to counteract that in the fire code. How?
Well, exactly. We know that putting in fire protection devices like sprinkler systems and extra exits and so on is expensive. And so if we allowed the market to decide who wants to pay for fire protection in buildings and who doesn't, what you'll find is that virtually everyone will not want to pay for it because it's very expensive. But of course, you know, after the Triangle Shirt Factory in New York, where we lost a number of people who died in a fire, we finally realized that we can no longer allow people to make those kind of decisions because we're going to end up acting irrationally. In other words, we're not going to pay for fire protection unless and until we need it. But by that time, it'll be too late. So we put in laws across the country, these fire codes that require all buildings that have that are public spaces to engage in these kind of fire protection devices. And so I think that's an example of how regulation is really meant to tie our own hands to prevent us from doing the things that we know we are going to want to do and that we know that we shouldn't do.
So are there ways to make sure that financial regulators, even though they're human, even though they are affected by the market and they think, well, things are going great, there's nothing that could go wrong, are there ways to sort of tie their hands and make sure that they do their job?
Well, I think there are. And I think that's an important observation. You know, we are now at a point of trying to figure out exactly what went wrong with the financial crisis and who to blame. And financial regulators are on the firing line as well. And there may be cause for blame, but rather than pointing fingers, a more productive way of responding to the crisis is by asking what actually did go wrong and what can we do in terms of making our laws more adaptive, make our regulations more adaptive so that we don't have to rely on human discretion. It's very difficult for human regulators to take away the punch bowl when the party is going strong. Nobody wants to be the party pooper. But if we understand that you need to take the punch bowl away when the party is going the strongest, we can actually implement that in a regulatory fashion in the same way that we implement fire code. So we need regulation that's more adaptive and less dependent upon human intervention.
And it is amazing how humans adjust to the situation. We've just been through, obviously, a few years of a really tough stock market. But I remember being in college and the tech boom was going on. And I had a friend who went to work for Merrill Lynch and I asked him, how he was investing. And he said, he's investing everything, even his rent money for like next month. It's in the market. And I said, really? I don't know. Is that safe? And he said, but why would you miss out? I could have 20% more rent money at the end of the month, right? People are so influenced by what's going on. And they think, as you say, like at the parties going on, it's never going to stop.
Well, that's right. In fact, you know, if you go through the internet bubble and look at the crash of the internet bubble from 2000 to 2002, I think the only lesson that people learned during that period was to buy on dips. So that we really didn't engage in any kind of risk reduction, after that internet bubble. In fact, things continued to grow, as we know, until the financial crisis hit. So I think that we are all prisoners of our own times, and this is part of evolution as well. We respond to our current market conditions, but unlike other animals, we have the ability to visualize and be able to understand different scenarios. And one of the scenarios that we have to prepare for is the regular occurrence of financial crises, and therefore we need to be able to plan for those in advance.
So let's talk about, as individuals, how to think about the stock market now that you know your instincts, your sort of evolutionary instincts may be pushing you in a different direction. I'm going to play one more clip from Frank Partnoy, where he's talking about why slow investing can be better than fast investing, at least for individuals.
When people engage in active trading strategies, when they day trade, when they follow the markets hour by hour, average investors tend to make very bad decisions. They tend to trade too much. They tend to buy and sell at the wrong times. They tend to pay hefty fees when they shouldn't. And that people are much better off with passive strategies. And in fact, if you look at the best investors, the best performing investors, even so-called activist investors, it's interesting that we label people as activist, that they operate much more slowly. And if you ask Warren Buffett about his strategies, he describes investing as approaching lethargy, as an incredibly lazy activity.
Andrew Lowe from MIT. So, okay, here you are, an individual. Obviously, everybody's trying to make sure that they have the most money that they can when they get to retirement. And I want to talk about a few of the things Frank Partnoy said. One is following the market is not that good. What do you think?
Well, you know, I think that there's some wisdom to that. I think that there's a very big difference between investing and trading. And I think most people often confuse the two. Investing is really about the long term, and trading is about the short term. Both are important, but they're engaged in different activities with different objectives and different kinds of skills. And so I think that following the market, following the crowd, can be dangerous if you don't know where the crowd is going or why it's going there. Just look at lemmings. You probably wouldn't want to follow them very long. So I think it's important for us to spend more time thinking about investments, trying to understand what our financial objectives are and how best to achieve them.
Okay. And then this idea of passive strategies. John Bogle, who famously helped found Vanguard, has basically said people are not good at making decisions. Not only just regular people, even professionals aren't very good. So the best thing to do is buy index funds, right, which just kind of track the market and sit back for 20, 30, 40 years and wait for the magic to happen, because that's the best way of approaching it. What do you think?
Well, you know, I think that was good advice. And certainly from the 1930s to the 1990s, when you take a look at financial markets in the United States, you see that the market conditions were relatively stable. The problem is that when market conditions are no longer stable, that kind of advice, buy and hold, 60% stocks, 40% bonds, a kind of passive approach to investing, may not continue to work over the course of the next 10 years. For example, if volatility shoots up or down like a roller coaster ride, then this buy and hold strategy can actually be quite dangerous. So I think that we have to update our understanding of financial markets because we have a new reality to deal with. The fact that risks are much greater today than they have been before because of a variety of macroeconomic conditions. So while we might not believe that we can pick stocks or that we can figure out what the next IBM or Microsoft is going to be, we can still be active about managing our risk. And I think that's really the new lesson for the current market conditions. It's that you can be passive about trying to generate superior investment returns, but everybody should be active about managing risks and make sure that you don't get killed by that train that's coming at you.
Well, you know, people often say that the market is driven by fear and greed. What do you do when you see the market going down, and everybody's had this experience, 300, 700, 1,000 points, and your money is disappearing before your eyes? How do you fight that fearful instinct, which, as you say, evolutionarily may make total sense, but maybe to sell at that moment doesn't really make a lot of sense?
Yeah, well, so any kind of financial decision made under emotional duress is likely to lead to bad outcomes. So I think that's the first recognition, that if you're engaging in a very strong emotional reaction, either fear or greed, it's probably not a good idea to be making financial decisions at that moment. Better yet is to step back early enough so that you're not in the midst of a crisis and ask yourself, how much loss can you really withstand? And beyond that loss, what are you planning to do? And then to work with either a broker or financial advisor or family and friends to sort of come up with a plan and engage in regular fire drills to ask, what if the market tanked by 10% today? What am I going to do today? And to go through those kind of drills on a regular basis so that you can prepare for these kind of events.
So like the Triangle Fire, sort of think about the worst before it happens.
Exactly.
And then I wonder, too, about somebody like Warren Buffett, who has obviously gotten so much attention as this really good investor. Is he somehow evolutionarily different? Does he have ice water running through his veins so that when terrible things happen, he thinks, yeah, whatever, that's fine? Or when really good things happen in the market, he also sort of sits back and takes the big view. How is he so good?
Well, so, you know, I'm not sure that there's a single answer to this, but if you take a look at Warren Buffett, you can look at his historical background, his biography, and you'll notice that since a very early age, Warren was absolutely fascinated by markets, by companies, by annual reports, things that would make most people's eyes glaze over, like reading an accounting statement for a company. Buffett just delighted in. I think the fact is he really loves what he does. And I think that's true with anybody who's really successful. They're not successful because they've decided to be successful. They're successful because they absolutely love what they're doing, and they become good at it because they spend so much more time than the rest of us thinking about these issues. I think that's one aspect. The other aspect, of course, is that Warren Buffett may have just been blessed with a brain that works in a particular way to be able to analyze economic decisions much better than most, in the same way that certain idiot savants can do do mathematical calculations better than the rest of us. I think that there are certain elements of both that explain Buffett's success. And by the way, he's not alone. There are many other people that have had tremendous success in investments, and they have similar kinds of makeups.
But you think he may not be subject to maybe the same degree of evolutionary fear that some of us are when we see the market dropping potentially?
Well, that's right. I think that he has a much better balanced degree of fear and greed. He can actually step back and analyze companies from a more rational perspective. Not to say that he has no fear whatsoever. Obviously, if you have no fear, you end up doing some really stupid things. And Buffett, of course, has lost money, but over the years, he's managed to be able to analyze both the prospects of a company as well as the emotional aspects and balance those two in just the right way.
Final question. Now that you've thought about biology and how it connects to finance, does it change at all how you do your own investing and manage your own money?
Well, it does. You know, I'm now much more wary of extreme financial duress. When you have big losses or big gains, those are not the moments to be able to make financial decisions. You really need to plan ahead. And I think planning ahead is something that applies to all walks of life and all professions. The more we can understand what drives our decisions during the worst moments of our lives, the more likely it is that we can prevent those bad decisions from happening and think more systematically about what we want to achieve.
I've been speaking about biology and finance with Andrew Lo, professor of finance and director of the Lab for Financial Engineering at MIT Sloan School. Andrew Lo, thank you so much for joining us.
It was a delight. Thank you.
So who will be the next chair of the Massachusetts GOP? A lot of people are tossing their hats into the ring. And today, Kelly Crosley kicks off a series of interviews with the candidates. She will be bringing you that conversation. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Boston Public Radio.